Okay, that was completing where we left off yesterday afternoon. So we're now looking at this sutta on how to deal with ill will and deal with resentment. And this is part of right action, as I mentioned before. Right effort. And we have looked at so far how to deal with people who have a variety of qualities. Bad ones, good ones. The last one was just bad qualities. And that's why you have to have compassion, because you can't see anything good in that person. And now we come to the last person. And the last person is the one who has just good qualities. Yeah. So this is also a little bit interesting. So let's have a look at this one. So this is what Venerable Sariputta has to say. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and from time to time gains an opening of the mind, lucidity of mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit and lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind, that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have a person who has all good qualities. Speech is good, actions are good, the mind is in a good place. And still, people get angry, right? this is a reality. It doesn't really matter, because anger has often said more about us than it says about the other person. And you get angry because of your own kind of misperceptions and your own silliness, and that's why it tends to arise. And you read the sutras, you see people getting angry with the Buddha. Yeah, they come up to the Buddha and they kind of abuse him and scold him and tell him off. There's a famous sutta where there's a Brahmin called the Akosaka Bharadvaja, the Akosaka Bharadvaja sutta, quite a well-known sutta, found in the Sanghita Nikaya. And Akosaka means the one who scolds, right? So it's just obviously not a real name, it's just a name which kind of suits the situation, right? So it's the Bharadvaja who scolds, is quite literally his name, right? And he's a Brahmin. It comes up to the Buddha, and he has heard that the Buddha is ordaining all these Brahmins to become monks. He doesn't like this. Brahmins are supposed to be Brahmins, not supposed to become Buddhist monks. So it tells the Buddha off, and he kind of really abuses him really badly here. And then the Buddha gives this nice reply. The Buddha just kind of sits there, doesn't really react very much. And then after he's finished, the Buddha says, I don't accept any of your abuse, it all belongs to you. He says, it's just as if, you know, you have a party and you invite all these people over for dinner. If there isn't a leftover food after the dinner, who does that food belong to? It belongs to you. In the same way, this anger belongs to you. I don't accept it. And the idea is that he is the one who has the problem. He is the one who has the consequences of what he's doing here. And it's quite a well-known little sutta. So be careful, because the anger you have towards others, it belongs to you. It comes back to you. If the other person is completely cool, it doesn't affect them at all. The only person it affects is actually yourself. So a nice way of thinking about that. So this is the problem here, yeah, that we get angry regardless, really. It doesn't matter if the anger is justified or not, because it has to do with us often, rather than actually the object that we are looking at. So here you have this nice idea, but similarly here, the idea of the pond, right? This kind of pond has clear, sweet and cool water, beautiful water, beautiful person, with smooth banks on the outside. There's no algae, there's no water plants this time. Everything is just beautiful. And the delightful place which shaded by various trees, and everything is just wonderful. So not only is the water cool, but even the surroundings. If you want to hang around this person, even then, it is kind of nice. Yeah? This seems to be the implication here. Then this angry man comes again, afflicted, oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched, and after that he plunged into the pool, yeah? You bathe and you drink. You cool down. You thank it both internally and externally. And then the interesting thing is, once you have cooled down and you kind of see the person for what this person is, yeah, you see that actually it is a very good person with so many good qualities, then what do you do? You sit down or lie down in the shade of the tree right there. And the idea of this seems to be that then you become the disciple of the person, yeah? So first you cool down, okay, cool down first then. And once you're cool, once you can see things properly, then you become the disciple, because you realize, actually, this person is worthy of respect. This person has some really good qualities. So it's interesting how this thing goes. And this is kind of the point, of course, with that sort of people. They are worthy of becoming a student of them, because they can show you something really worthwhile knowing about the world, something about real happiness and suffering. Yeah. So it's a wonderful thing. Yeah. And as I was saying before, and I think I mentioned briefly before, the idea of what the Buddha says in the suttas, that even the seeing an arahat in the world, the seeing somebody who is awakened, is of a massive, great benefit and advantage. Because when you see somebody like that, you see something which is different. You see somebody who doesn't react in normal ways. You see somebody who has much more profound peace of mind, has much more time for other people, compassion, all of these qualities. And it kind of stops in the tracks and think, wait, what's going on here? This is different. And it reminds you that there are things in this world that are beyond our ordinary experience. There are things that are, to be moved towards, things that are really incredibly valuable, things that most people have no idea about. That is what the presence of somebody like that actually does to you. It stops you like that and you think, whoa, there's something here, something powerful going on here. So this is what happens, obviously, when you meet the Buddha or you meet other people who have specially practiced on the path. And then, of course, that is how you then remove that resentment and anger towards that person. And the last little phrase here, it says, friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. And that's precisely the point, right? You keep on observing somebody and they inspire confidence in every respect, then of course, as a consequence of that, confidence arises in you. Interesting for those who study Pali here, maybe not so many, but the word here used for inspiring confidence in every way is Samantapasadika. Yeah, so Samantapasadika is the word for the Vinaya commentary. So for those who are monastics especially, the Vinaya commentary by Buddha Gosa is called the Samantapasadika, and this seems to be where that word is taken from. The only place where it occurs in the sutta, as it seems, is in this particular place. Just as a small side note on that one. So, that is the last person. So, quite easy to abandon ill will towards this person. But nevertheless, it is one of the five ways. So, these friends are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whoever it has arisen. Yeah, so again, this idea that nobody is excluded. Everybody can remove resentment towards everybody on the Buddhist path. And I think one of the things that is, is quite important in on the Buddhist path is precisely this idea of not having any enemies in the world. If you have enemies, if you have people you kind of find, you have kind of grudges or resentment towards, it's going to be very hard to purify the mind properly. It's going to be very impossible to have proper metta. It's going to be impossible to kind of take the mind into these deep stages of samadhi like we're doing here. So it is important that we don't have anyone in the world that we really have any anger towards or ill will or negativity towards. So we use these methods. So even though people may not be good, we can recognize that. We have tools and ways of dealing with that so that we don't actually be angry with them or negative towards them. And only then, when you don't have any enemies in the world, right? It's a beautiful idea of having any enemies. Everyone is like your friend. What other people do to you, whether they like you or they consider you an enemy or whatever, that's outside of what we can do anything about. We can't do anything about that. You have to allow other people to have whatever silly opinions they might have about you. You have to shrug your shoulders and kind of just forget about it. But at least you are not going to have any grudge or resentment towards them just because they may not treat you 100% right, or they may even have a wrong ideas about you. Okay, it's their problem. They're the ones who have to suffer for that. You can just kind of, you know, move on and do your things, and then there's no issue for you there anymore. Then, when you have no problems in that way, nobody you're really angry towards, then the whole idea of metta comes from that. So a natural extension from the sutta, overcoming anger, now we move towards the idea of developing metta. This is what I want to talk about next, because it comes naturally from this, and emerges from this. You abandon these negative problems, and then you move on to the metta practice. So I'm going to look at a couple of suttas that talk about metta in particular. And I'm going to talk about one very simple sutta, first of all, which talks about how to do this in very kind of in a very basic fashion, in a basic way. Sometimes we need to come back to basics, because the basics are then the foundation upon which everything else, of course, happens. The basics are always more important. People think that as you progress on the path, you let go of the basic things and you do the higher things. But that's not really how the path works. The path, of course, works that when you move to a higher level, you take the basic elements with you to the higher level. So, you know, when you have real metta of the mind, you know, through your meditation or whatever, of course, the more basic types of metta, the non-anger, you carry that with you into that state. So as you move forward on the path, you always take the more basic things with you. This is why there is no such thing as crazy wisdom. Yeah. Either you're crazy or you're wise. You can't be both. So because of that, because you take those basic things, the basic virtue, all of those things, you bring it with you all the way to the very end. When you become an arahant, you are virtuous. You don't do kind of silly stuff just because you're fully enlightened. Yeah, I'm enlightened now, I can do whatever I want. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work like that. Yeah, look how the path works. So sometimes we just have to use a bit of common sense and not kind of allow ourselves to be hoodwinked by all kind of, you know, ideas that are really actually sometimes take you completely in the wrong direction and various other things. So anyway, let's have a look at the Kosambien Sutta, to the Kosambien. And this is where this sutra starts off. There is an argument in the Sangha. All the monks are arguing with each other, and it's all kinds of problems. And then the Buddha, he speaks to the monks to try to resolve this dispute in the Sangha. And one of the teachings that he has is how to have harmony in the Sangha, how to kind of live in concord and in unity. And there are six factors that he talks about for how to live in concord and harmony within a group. Yeah, there can be any kind of group, really. It's a very nice little sutra. And I have many of the sutras I have here are just extracts, short passages, because they are the most kind of important things as far as this retreat is concerned. But you may wish to go back and actually look at these sutras in full, because many of them have a lot of more interesting information in them, which you may find inspiring and interesting. So this is just like whetting your appetite for the sutra. Then you get a tiny extract, and you're like, what is the rest going on here? I want to know. It's a kind of a trick to kind of draw you into the sutra, you see. I'm being very kind of crafty here. Anyway, so this is how it goes. So these are three of these principles that you use to create unity and harmony here. Here, a bhikkhu maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, that conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord. This is again this word harmony, concord, and to unity. Very simple, and very basic. But what is interesting about this is that here, normally when we think about loving kindness, metta, we think about sitting down and spreading loving kindness, either to individuals, according to kind of the Visuddhimagga tradition, or to the whole world by spreading it to the various directions. That's how often people talk about this. But much more basic than that is the idea of just acting out of loving kindness in ordinary life, how we treat people on a daily basis. This is much more foundational, right? This is something everyone can do. This is something we actually are able to do. Whether we can sit down and really spread loving kindness to the whole world, we can try that, but whether it actually really works, whether it gives rise to any good feelings inside or not, that is much more iffy. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But this kind of thing, we can do that. Yeah, we know, because we can always act with kindness. And the point is that when you do these basic practices, you kind of learn a certain attitude towards other people. You learn to think about them in a certain way. This is kind of the purpose here. And when you do that, you are gradually enabling your mind to turn towards loving kindness also in the meditation practice. It's so important to start with the basics, start with the foundations, and then build on that. If you don't get the basics right, there's going to be a house without foundations, right? Cardboard foundations and then bricks on top is not going to be very useful. So this is so important, to start with the ideas of doing things by body and speech, then move on to the mind. I mentioned the other day how I went to visit Ajahn Gandha, this very famous monk in Thailand, who is very famous for his loving kindness. Right? This is one of the stories. It's like an inside story, so you have to promise or to tell anyone else. You promise? this is one of the inside stories in the Sangha. I'm not really know if I'm supposed to tell it or not, but I'll tell it anyway, because it's kind of a nice story. And it's kind of a slightly strange story, but very interesting in many ways. And this was a story where, this is from Ajahn Chah's monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And of course, Ajahn Brahm was there for many years. On one occasion, all the monks were present. Ajahn Chah was there, maybe this was a Patimokkha ceremony or something like that. And then Ajahn Chah, he asked the monks, I don't know if this is common or not, but he asked the monks, Is there anyone here who has kind of finished the practice, just kind of gone all the way to the end of the path? Yeah. And then there is one monk. I don't know if this is actually, you know, what this actually implies, what it means necessarily, but one monk raises his hand. Yeah, I have no more defilements. This happens to be Ajahn Gandha. Yeah. He says, I don't have any more defilements. So sometimes we overestimate ourselves and make it wrong. So this doesn't mean absolutely true that he is an arahant. But certainly he seemed to think that himself. And then Ajahn Chah says, well, okay, he takes him to his duty and he gives him some advice. Yeah, and then he says, well, now, you know, your job now, from now on, is just to have metta. Yeah, to have metta to the whole world. Because if you are an arahant, you're finished with the path, there's nothing more to be done. Your job is to have metta to the world and then teach them on that basis. So you help other people as much as possible. Yeah, it's quite a remarkable story. I wasn't sure myself what to make of that story when I first heard it. But this is the kind of thing that sometimes you hear as a monastic, which is it's inspiring. And it's also kind of interesting how these things work. So because of that, he has now become famous for his metta, because he has followed Ajahn Chah's instruction to a point, and all he does have is metta. He just sits there. And as I said before, it's like this blob of kindness, yeah? You have this kind of feeling of somebody who is, because it's quite fat as well, small and fat and full of kindness, yeah? So it kind of fits very well there. So then, because he's famous for this, and he's always been practicing in this way, I asked him, what is the best way of practicing metta? And one of the nice things when you meet people who have really gone a long way on the path, who you feel have really attained things, usually the way they teach is very simple. Yeah, it's not like me, I give you all this complicated stuff, right? It's really, really simple teaching, it's really kind of basic stuff. And this is what it's so beautiful about, that you get this feeling that this person, they kind of bring you back down to earth again, get you out of your head, not thinking too much, and just do the basics. So I asked him, how do you practice metta? And he said, well, how should one practice metta, or something to that effect? And he said, he didn't say anything about sitting down and kind of spreading metta to the four directions. Nothing at all about that. And what he said is that the way to do it is that when you wake up in the morning, every day, you should ask yourself, what good can I do for the world today? Yeah, what can I do today to kind of help those people that cross my path? That's what he said about practicing metta. And of course, this is exactly what this is about, yeah? It is exactly the idea of practicing metta by body and afterwards by speech. In other words, we kind of bring it alive by how we live our life on a day-to-day basis. And if we do this in the right way, if we do it consistently, not just every day, but ideally moment to moment all the time, then of course then this becomes very powerful. And this is when your seedless starts to develop, your character starts to develop very fast as a consequence. So this is how these are basic. These things may sound like they're very basic, but actually, so much of the path actually lies in these things, right? They're not really basic at all. It is doing this consistently, moment to moment, all the time. Actually, it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance to be able to do that. So sometimes you want to move on to the more advanced stages, but the problem is that the basic stages actually are already quite advanced in their own right, if you want to do them fully. And this is kind of the point of this. Remember that, and then that you have some idea of of what actually really matters. And then, of course, if you really are able to do this fully, then when you sit down in your meditation tends to be very easy. It tends to happen very naturally, precisely because the foundation is so strong. So anyway, let's get back and have a look at some of the details of what he's saying here. Right? You have loving kindness both in public and in private. And this is the idea of integrity, the idea that we act the same in private as we do in public. The idea is that you're always kind, not just kind as a show-off or anything like that. It is it's a part of who you are, rather than an aspect of trying to please people or something like that. And then you have this interesting thing here. You have this towards your companions in the holy life. Pali word is the brahmacharya, the people who practice the brahmacharya together with you. And this here then refers to your companion monks, right? Or your companion nuns in the Bhikkhuni Sangha. This is where you should have this loving kindness by act, and then by speech, and then by mind afterwards. So what about you guys? Should I just kind of ignore all the lay people and say, forget about the lay people, lay people are irrelevant, it doesn't monastic matter. That's what it means. And of course it doesn't mean that, right? That would be crazy to think it means that. That's not what it means. What it means is that if you are going to have loving kindness, often the most people who are most difficult to have real loving kindness towards are the people who are closest to you. Because the people who are closest to you are the people you rub up against all the time. It's kind of hard when you see the monks every day. You have to deal with some monks you find maybe you have kind of personality difference with, right? So you can't really see eye to eye with him. And you have to talk to him every day and kind of sort out. Oh no, what dukkha, right? But that is where the problems arise. And that is where the kind of the issues come about. So that is where the main work of loving kindness is. The people who are closest to you, your family members, your closest friends. That is where it can be often very hard to have metta, precisely because of closeness. But the point is that if you can have metta towards those, it's really metta, really easy to have metta towards everyone else. It's quite easy to have metta towards one of you, because I meet you how often? I meet you once every, maybe I never meet you again, this may be the last time. So how difficult is that? I meet you in very nice circumstances. We don't have to talk too much. If we talk too much, that's when kind of the metta starts to go down. So it's all of these things that are very... But this is quite easy. And that is really the point here. So the point is to understand where the real metta practice is and focus on that, and that everything else tends to fall into place as a consequence. So this is what is happening here. This is what this is all about. So very useful thing to remember. And actually, it is not that difficult to have metta towards, especially if you are a monk, towards your fellow monks, because these are people who try to live a very good life, who try their very best to live with integrity, to do the right thing. Their intentions are really good. Their heart is in the right place. So it's very easy to kind of forgive little things. And remember the same thing when you hang out with your fellow Buddhists, right, or Buddhist community, people who are good, very often it's exactly the same thing. These are people who are really trying here. Even if they have a bad kind of personal habits or whatever it is, which many people of course have, at least they're trying here. And for goodness sake, they're worthy of lots of respect for even trying to change themselves and move in a good direction here. This is the kind of stuff that you think about. So start off with the people who are close to you. This is one of those really important things. And this is also one of those things about virtue in general, the idea of sila. Sometimes we talk also in Buddhism, what about kind of the big issues in life? And I think I mentioned this before, but maybe worthwhile mentioning again very briefly here. you're talking about the big issues. So what about Sila in regard to kind of the world as a whole, right? Inequality in the world and climate change and all of these ethical things that are out there, and we've got to face it. There are lots of problems. But the point is, and that ethics on a personal level with the people you interact with on a daily basis is far more important, because it touches you in a much more powerful way here. If you want to have, you know, have a pure mind, then the purity of the mind comes much more from those people who are close to you, that you interact with all the time. That purity does not come so much from how you deal with the large and big issues in the world. Sure, you know, help out with doing what is right, you know, whatever that might be, and certainly do so, but don't make that the mainstay of the virtue, because then it's not going to have any real effect in your practice. So this is what that is about. So that is the loving kindness through actions. So this is this principle of cordiality here. It creates love and respect. It creates cohesion, non-dispute, concord. Concord is sammagga in Pali here. It's this nice word that brings, first of all, it means bringing together. You stay together here. And then it also from that also comes the idea of having harmony, not just being together, but having harmony together at the same time. That's where that comes from. And to unity. Okay. Then we have the next one. Again, a bhikkhu maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. Yeah, so again, same idea as before. Now we're talking about how to speak, and speaking is sometimes even more difficult than bodily acts, because speaking happens so fast, right? Before you know it, something has escaped from your mouth, but you think, whoa, why shouldn't I have said that? And it's kind of too late, then you have to do something else instead. So exactly the same principle again. Start with the more basic things. And then the last one. Again, the bhikkhu maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This is the principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to all these things. That conduces to, what is it called? It conduces to cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity here. Okay, so that is, so here we have, we're moving on to the mind, right? We're not necessarily dealing with loving kindness meditation yet at this stage. What we're dealing with here is just your ordinary mental attitude in ordinary life. So this is exactly what we have been looking at in the previous sutta. The sutta which is about overcoming anger and reminding ourselves of the good qualities of other people. This is what this really is about. So being able on a daily basis to think well about the people that we meet. This is what this is about. And this is about the entire sutta we just used. That is what you use in these kind of situations to be able to overcome that and maintain that goodwill to other people around you. And if you do this consistently, I can assure you it will change your outlook, change your mindset, change the way that you deal with other people and how you think about them. The most important thing is to, again, just to be consistent and to be persevere and do it again and again. And as you do that, things will happen. This don't happen overnight. Yeah, this is the most important thing here. And as you do that, you will be able to, your whole attitude will start to shift. Look at people differently. There will still be situations where you won't be able to keep your cool, you won't be able to do the right thing. But it will be reduced by a massive amount. And that is really what really matters here. So, that is the mental act, of loving kindness, both in public and in private. You go back to your room, you go back to your kutina, and you still have all these beautiful thoughts about your fellow Buddhist or whatever it is on this path. Okay, so that is the kind of the basic ideas of loving kindness. And from there, this is where kind of the next step after this, of course, is actually doing this in one's meditation practice. So I'm just going to give you some hints about how to actually make this work in your meditation practice. And the first thing is that the way I like to do loving kindness meditation, I don't usually, it varies a bit, but I try not to spread it so much to individual that how does to kind of use the four directions in the sensor. And it has some advantages. One is that if you do it to individuals, once you see your personality there, it's very difficult to focus 100% just on the good qualities. It can be very hard to do that. But when you have like a direction, right, just another direction from here or whatever, and all you see is an imagination, you can kind of build it up in exactly the way you like it. Because it is an imagination, it's actually quite much easier to focus on the good qualities of those beings that are out there, whatever they may be. So I quite like that, and I will tell you in a second a little bit about another reason why I like to do it that way, because there's some interesting research that, on the sutta that was done by, again, I haven't mentioned Venerable Analia again, you probably, so, but he did some very interesting research on this particular topic, very kind of convincing and well-argued. I'll talk a little bit about that in a second, too, just to give you some flavor of what that is about. The basic idea is then to kind of just do things to the four directions without doing it to anyone in particular. That is the way I like to do it. You don't have to do it that way. You can do it in whatever way you like. If you like to do it towards individual because that works for you, please do so. There is no kind of absolute recipe here on how to do these things. It's just there are certain ways that it, that tends to work for different individuals. The only way that I like to do it this way is because this is how it tends to be described in the suttas. The Buddha never said anything about spreading metta to individuals. It's actually a later development. You find it in the Sutta Magga and these kind of things. And for that reason, this is the way I prefer to do it. But again, as long as you are able to give rise to those positive feelings, that is really the most important thing here. So to do this, remember one of the kind of basic ideas of metta is to see the good qualities in other beings. Yeah? People, animals, ghosts, heavenly beings is great to focus on because we know that there's going to be so many good qualities there. We can focus on all those heavenly beings out there as well. Because that kind of is quite, I don't know if you have any ability to do that. But I guess it depends on your faith and confidence in how the world works. But if that works for you, it can be a nice way of doing it. So remember, first of all, establish in your mind this idea of the goodness, right? Of the good qualities in other beings. And you may have noticed when I started the meditation on loving kindness a couple of days ago, I started off by saying, bring to mind the idea of good qualities. What do these qualities, what do they actually mean? What do they feel like? What does it mean to be generous? What does it mean to be kind? What does it mean to be compassionate? What does it mean to kind of to love someone, not in a relationship sense of love, but in a sense of kind of brotherly love, that kind of love, yeah? Sisterly or brotherly love. And once you bring these qualities to mind, especially when you kind of feel what these things mean, yeah? That is when you start, and you start to give rise to that, and then you remind yourself that actually there are lots of beings in this world who have these particular qualities. People, beings who are really worthy of respect, beings who are worthy of your well-wishing, people whom, you know, it is relatively easy to wish well because they have so many good qualities. So bring that to mind. Remind yourself that there are lots of beings that have these qualities out there, particularly devas in very high kind of reborn in very high realms precisely because they have those qualities. And then focus on one direction. And wish all those beings well out there who are there. Yeah, so this is then one way of doing that. A positive perception that then gives rise to your ability to wish them well as a consequence. So there's nothing very magical about it. It's fairly kind of a relatively straightforward, I think. But of course, it will take time before often you're able to give rise to these feelings. It depends on all the other factors on the path. And when all of these other factors come together, that is often when it starts to work. So we'll do one more guided metta meditation, maybe tomorrow before we leave, just to kind of reinforce the message of these particular suttas. And the way that the metta is described in the suttas, I haven't actually included it in the pages here, which probably I should, but I'll read it out for you, because it's quite nice the way it is described here. Or maybe it is actually included, yeah? Yeah, it's kind of coming afterwards. Actually, it's not described in full detail, so I'll bring it out. So, let's read it out for you. So this is how, this is the standard way that metta meditation is described in the suttas. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, metta. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, to all as to himself, that is the kind of the one which is talked about later on, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Yeah, so this is the kind of the standard way that it is described. Very simple. Because to all the quarters, to everywhere, without any kind of limitation, there's no boundaries in your mind. There's no one who is screened off, who is kind of put in a small enclosure and excluded from everything else. Everyone is part of this. And you are part of this too. And this is why it isn't really necessary to have a special metta for oneself. I know that this is what the Visuddhimagga recommends, but it's not really required because you are part of the whole world. If you have metta for everything, you are part of that. You're not going to be excluded. I don't know about you, but I always find it slightly artificial to have metta, try to have metta for myself. I don't know if maybe it works for some people, but I always find it slightly kind of awkward and weird. Much more natural just to spread it out to everyone, and then you are kind of included in that. It's kind of a more inclusive thing. It seems almost like a little bit too self-centered to me to kind of think about yourself in that way. Anyway, I guess if it works for you, great. But for me, I never felt quite at ease, or didn't really work for me all that well there. And then you have these beautiful ideas of the mind that is abundant and exalted in all of these kind of things, right? It's a mind which has grown large, which is kind of this idea of no boundaries inside of you anymore. It just spreads out without any kind of limitation. This is why it is abundant and exalted and immeasurable. Yeah, there's no sense of limits to this kind of mind anymore. Without hostility and without ill will. So, that is the basic description there. So, okay. So, one of the things that I wanted to mention briefly, and this is actually one of the things that is, one of the things that Analio has pointed out, is written quite a lot of very interesting papers, because he talks about things that are often very practical and very useful on the Buddhist path. Not always, but often he does. And one of these papers was about precisely about how to develop compassion and metta according to the suttas. Yeah, and you may have just have heard, I was just reading this out, it said that you have metta to everyone or everywhere as you have to yourself. Yeah, and this particular word, this to everyone as to oneself, this is actually the word that he brought up in this particular paper and discussed. And the word in Pali is sabbapataya, is the Pali word there. And depending on how you spell it, there's only one difference. There's an H in there. Now, the H in Pali is actually quite hard to hear because an H is usually silent. It's not silent, but it is an aspiration. There's only a tiny difference in pronunciation. Either you aspirate it with a breath sound, or it's not aspirated. If it's aspirated with a breath sound, then the H is in there. If it's not, then there is no H there. That's the only difference. So it's very easy for you to slide from one to the other one. A slight difference in hearing it, and you get it completely wrong here. So he investigated this, and I think it's fair to say that he discovered, and I think it's perfectly what he came to. I think it's very solid. And actually, there has been a shift in this word over time, from the word with has an H in it to the one without the H. And the meaning of between the two actually is significantly different. If it has an H, then it just means that you spread it out to everywhere, right? The whole world, without any limits. That's all it means. As soon as you take the H out, then you have to look at it differently. Then it means to all as to yourself. In other words, oneself, atta, right? Like an anatta, atta, that kind of word becomes included there. And then the meaning becomes very different. And he argues, I think, very convincingly, that then the whole tradition, the Visuddhimagga idea of starting with yourself as a meditation object is actually derived from that idea where the spelling change had already happened. And for that reason, the whole Theravada tradition has started to meditate in this particular way. You start with yourself, then other individuals. So, where in the sutta, it is not based on individuals at all. Yeah, it's very rare that you get these kinds of fairly substantial differences. It's actually very rare in the suttas. Usually, the words seem to be very reliable. This is kind of one of the very special cases. But I think his research is very solid. His research is based on the fact that the spelling of this word is not consistent in the suttas. It varies depending on which editions you read. This is always a kind of red flag. Why is it different readings? Yeah. Then it is based on the fact that in all the other languages, in Chinese and other languages that the suttas are in, it actually means the whole world. It does not mean as to oneself, to all as to oneself. Yeah, and then there are other arguments in there about how the structure of language works and all of these kind of things. I think the argument is very interesting. And I show this to Abhanta Sujato. The Abhanta Sujato, he has always had this technique of meditation where you do it to individuals. So I thought he might not like this particular interpretation because that's the way he has, tends to do his metta meditation. But he also was convinced by the article because it actually is quite convincing. So even in that case, it was quite clear. So again, and this is another reason why I think actually the idea of spreading metta to the whole world actually is more in accordance with, I think, the Buddha's intentions, I think, than the idea of doing it to individuals. So at the end of the day, do it in a way that works for you. That is by far the most important thing. And then take it from there. You can try a few different things and see what works, and then work do your meditation on that basis. So now what I would like to do is to have some little bit of a look at another nice sutta. This is also about metta. This is the famous simile of the soul, Majjhima Nikaya 21. And I may bring in a few more. There's a lot of number of similes in this particular sutta that are very nice, and they talk about what your mind becomes like. Yeah, what sort of mind you have once metta is developed to a very high extent. But first of all, we'll start off with a little bit of the background here. So this is what the Buddha has to say here. So, two bhikkhus, there are these five ways of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. This is already quite interesting because this shows us a little bit about the idea of how to speak. Yeah, this is kind of additional information apart from the idea of right speech that we have seen before. We did talk about timely speech before, timely and untimely. The idea that you know when it is appropriate to talk, when the other person is interested or when they're open rather than when you just want to talk. True and untrue, obviously fairly straightforward, gentle and harsh. We have seen that already. Connected with good or connected with harm. So again, this is what I was saying, that this, sometimes you say things that people may not actually want to hear, but you have to say it, especially if you are the Buddha, you have to say things because you need to sort things, problems out, even if people don't want to hear about it. And the last one, spoken with a mind of loving kindness and not with inner hate. Yeah, this is the ideal way of speaking here. But the point, of course, here is that even though we try to speak like this and try to move in that direction, it is not always going to happen. A lot of the time in the world, you're going to hear speech that it doesn't have these kind of qualities. It has maybe sometimes all five of the bad qualities kind of coming together and kind of wham. And that is that can often be very difficult. Speech is one of those things that is kind of tricky in the world because we have to, in the end, we have to endure a lot of speech which isn't quite very good, which doesn't live up to these kind of standards. And it is not something you can escape. Right? One of the things to remember that there are certain things in the world that we just have to endure. There's no point in trying to escape these things because there's always going to be people, regardless of what we do. Even if we hide away in a cave somewhere, somebody's going to come and kind of say something to you which isn't quite right, yeah? And this is kind of the nature of the world. This is just part and parcel of what it means to be human. You're going to hear bad speech sometimes. So after a while you think, okay, well, I'm going to have to, it's there, can't do anything about it. What's the point of getting angry? It's not going to resolve anything here. So you don't get angry and you turn the tables around again and you have a sense of metta or compassion towards the person instead. This is one of those things. It's the first stage of with many of these things. It's like accepting that this is the nature of the world. The nature of the world is not going to change even if you try to change it. So acceptance is often the first stage. And once you accept things, then you can kind of be patient with these things and you can deal with these things in the right way. So we need to look at the world squarely and to accept the problems that are there. And only then are we going to have success in developing these things. So this is the problem here, right? People come and they say all of these kind of things. And then the Buddha says how we should deal with that. Because you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no evil or bad words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare. With a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate, we shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide providing the all-encompassing world with a mind. Forget about that cat skin bag, because that shouldn't really be there. With a mind abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus. So here, the interesting point here, of course, I've just been telling you how to radiate metta to all the directions, but here it says you should start with that person. And this is, I think, the only place that I'm aware of in the suttas where it starts off with a person to have loving kindness towards somebody. And why is a person mentioned here? Well, here it's obviously someone who might be problematic. Yeah, someone who uses speech in the wrong way, who says bad things, and maybe we are on the verge of giving rise to some kind of negative thought or anger or something like that. So we start off by neutralizing that person to make sure that there is no blockages in the mind. We're assuming that we already don't have any enemies in the world, right? We are one of these people who have absolutely no enemies already. But here comes a potential enemy. Yeah? And if we're not careful, they're going to become an enemy very quickly. So we make sure we neutralize that problem straight away. And then we kind of subdue any tiny bit of ill will or negativity that may have arisen because of the bad speech of that person. So that is why we do that with that person first. And once that has been neutralized, then of course we come back to the stage, where we have no enemies. And because we have no enemies, then we can start spreading out the loving kindness to the whole world. So this here is very similar to what we were talking about in the sutta about the resentment. The resentment, anyone, where is the problem? You start with them, look at their good qualities, and overcome the negative by looking at the good qualities, and thereby arising metta for that person. Exactly the same principle, really. And then, once that is subdued, then you move on to this more encompassing practice and bringing everyone into it and having metta for the whole world in this way. So there you are. So this is what this is about. So what I thought of doing is that next part, aspect here now, is the simile of the soul. But actually this sutta has a number of very nice similes that are, I think, quite inspiring. They are kind of similes that show you how far it is possible to develop the mind in metta and how the mind can change the metta practice. They're inspiring because they're more like something to kind of aim towards rather than something that most people actually are able to access in their ordinary lives. So I'll read those out because we haven't given them the extra. I'm not sure why I didn't include them because I usually like to talk about these similes. This is continuing on the same sutta, Majjhimanikaya 21, the simile of the soul. Okay, so this is the first one. Bhikkhus, this is a simile again, right? So this is a simile. Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket. A hoe is like a digging tool, right, that they use to kind of dig the ground a little bit, and a basket, and said, I shall make this great earth be without earth. had one of these crazy ideas, come with a hoe in a basket and make the great earth be without earth. He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. What do you think, Vickers? Could not man make this great earth be without earth? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. It is not easy to make it be without earth. Eventually the man would only reap weariness and disappointment. This is what I mean, the Buddha is understated, right? It's not easy to make it be without earth. So this is kind of classical understatement. So here is this idea that your mind is like the great earth, yeah? So if someone comes and kind of urinates on your mind, and the idea here of urinating, of obviously saying something bad to you, doing something unpleasant, this is kind of the simile here, yeah? They spit on you perhaps, they urinate on you or whatever it is, because your mind is so vast, it hardly touches you, it touches one little corner of the great earth, and the rest of the earth is completely unaffected. The earth kind of shrugs its shoulders and doesn't really worry about this, it doesn't matter here. Yeah, and this is kind of the idea of the vast mind that is so large that any kind of little impingement on the corner of your vast personality is going to have no effect on the rest of the thing here. So you are like the great earth, you shrug off these little things. Yeah, so this is kind of the idea behind this. And elsewhere in the sutta, as the Buddha said, you should develop the mind like the earth. Yeah, and this is really what it seems to refer to here. This vast mind that has no kind of, the little things in the world have no bearings on that mind anymore. You're beyond that kind of problem. So one of the things that is so nice about the simile is they're kind of slightly over the top, and that's what is so kind of, what makes them so funny in a sense. The next one, next simile here. Because suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, and carmine and said it. These are all colors, right? Just to make it clear, these are kind of quaint English words for various colors, crimson and carmine and these kind of things. And said, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. This is another one of those kind of crazy ideas. I shall make pictures on empty space. Start drawing on empty space. What do you think, Vickers? Could that man draw and make pictures appear on empty space? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless and invisible. It is not easy to draw pictures there and make pictures appear there. Eventually that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Yeah, so here the person who is who kind of has developed metta is compared to empty space. You are like empty space when you have developed metta a long way ahead. Why is that? And the reason is because when you have a lot of metta, a large part of those things that you identify with as a person, they have kind of disappeared or they have become irrelevant. What you identify with now is the metta itself. And it's very hard for other people to kind of say anything about you that you are bad or anything which kind of touches you, because you are almost completely empty inside. There's very little left of the identity that you normally have. You still have a personality, but you don't really attach to that, or you don't really identify with your identity, so to speak. Yeah, you are almost empty inside. All that is left is the idea of loving kindness. And this is kind of the beautiful thing about this. This sense of emptiness, sense of not being a real, almost like you're not a real person anymore. All you have is this beautiful quality inside of you. If somebody tries to attack you or say something bad about you, it doesn't touch you anymore. You are free of all that kind of stuff. So this is what this seems to mean. It says here the person would only reap weariness and disappointment. They just become tired, right? They stop bothering. Why do they stop bothering you? Because they know that there's nothing, you can't get anything out of you anyway. You can't get you to react in any way whatsoever. You are beyond that react. You just smile when they say bad things to you. And either they think you're crazy and they leave, or they think that you are beyond being kind of being antagonized in any way whatsoever. This is, a very nice simile about being empty when you attain metta. Sometimes we think of emptiness as something almost scary. It's a bit like non-self, there's nothing left there or whatever in it. But actually, it's very beautiful when you hear about it in this way. It's the mind that all you have is metta. You don't think very much anymore. Nothing much happening inside of you. You just have this very good feeling inside. That's all there is. Okay. The next one, next simile here. Because, suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch. Grass torch is like a thing of grass, which is lit, right? So you can see where you're going. That's kind of the idea of a grass torch. And said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen the river Ganges, but the Rhine is small by comparison, right? So it's a really, really big river. It's enormous. It's like several kilometers wide in certain places. What do you think, figures? Could that man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with that blazing grass torch? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the river Ganges is deep and immense. It is not easy to heat it up or burn it away with a blazing grass torch. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So your mind becomes like the Ganges, right? Cool water flowing along very silently. And that coolness is so profound, it is so immense, it is so fully permeated in your personality. And if some little kind of tiny little bit of heat comes around, a little bit of anger, whatever it is, somebody else comes from the outside, it will have no effect on you. Exactly the same way as this torch has no effect on the river Ganges. You are this kind of this big river flowing through the world. There is another nice simile, I think it's found in the Sutta Nipata, I think it is. The simile of the difference between somebody who's really developed, like the superior person and the inferior person. And the simile says, well, all the kind of the ordinary people in the world, basically it says that it's all the small brooks, the small little streams in the world, they are the ones who make all the noise. The large rivers float silently. In exactly the same way, the real people who are attained on the path, they are silent. It's all the small rivers that make all, the small brooks that make all the noise. So the idea of the big river is like a simile used in several places in the suttas for the kind of the sage, the person who has gone a long way on the Buddhist path. So then there is one more, and that is the simile of the catskin bag. That's why the catskin bag was in that before, because that was the simile of the catskin bag. But the catskin bag, I don't know if anyone exists anymore. I've never heard of catskin bags before. And I think this is some kind of thing that existed in ancient India and it completely kind of got lost in translation over the centuries. So I'm going to leave that simile out and I'm going to go to the simile of the saw itself. We only have 1 minute and 20 seconds. We're going to do that quickly. So, okay, so this is the last simile here. Because even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Yeah, so the Buddha is really saying, he's setting the bar really, really high to be able to practice his teachings properly, to be a true disciple of the Buddha. This is what you have to do. Even if somebody hacks you apart, right? Limb by limb. No hate, no anger. Just may you be well and happy. This is what this is about. This is a great simile, right? It really drives you home of how powerful it is possible to develop the mind. It really is possible to go, so far. This is kind of what is so astonishing about this. Here in Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus. This really drives home the point, right? There is never really any basis for having anger if your mind is properly developed. And you may wonder, how is this possible? How can you kind of sit there, some really bad guys come out with a big saw, maybe a chainsaw, and start chopping off your arms and your legs or whatever, and all you have is metal for them. How is this even conceivable? How is that possible? Can you know it? And of course, the idea here is that you recognize who has the real problem in this kind of situation. If you are being chopped apart and your limbs are kind of falling off, you're not going to last very long, right? You're going to die pretty quickly if that happens. And then when you die, because you have loving kindness for the whole world, you're just going to go to a good destination. Okay, a little bit of pain for a while, big deal, no problem, right? You die, okay, you get reborn in a good place. So for you, it's no issue. This is how you have to think about this, right? But the person who chops you apart limb by limb, especially if you are a person who has loving kindness for the whole world in this way, you probably aren't arrogant by this stage to be able to do this kind of stuff. Yeah? So imagine the kind of karma they're making. Tremendously bad karma. Karma that is so bad. They have no idea what they're doing. They're completely deluded. They're completely walking around in the dark, bumping into walls all the time. That's what they're doing. And the suffering they're creating for themselves in the future is immense. They have absolutely no idea what's going on. And when you remember that, you, instead of actually getting angry and upset, you have compassion for them. Yeah, you understand that these people, actually, you feel sorry for them. They haven't got a clue what is going on. So instead of thinking about yourself, yes, this is painful, I can bear the pain. I'm going to kind of move on in a good direction anyway. It doesn't matter for me. These are the people who have the problem. Yeah, so this is a... The beauty of this is that sometimes it's almost like, whoa, I can't do that. But the point is, everyone can. It's just a matter of gradual training, gradual change. And one day, you are able to do this precise thing because your mind is so developed in that direction. So allow these things to be an inspiration for you. Yeah, something that is just astonishing that it's possible to do these kind of things. An inspiration on the path, rather than thinking that, oh, I can't do this. So, you know, it's almost like the Buddha's asking too much, I don't want to hear about this, or whatever. Allow yourself to be something that inspires you, because it is actually so lofty, and it is so beautiful, to even imagine that this kind of thing is possible. This does not mean that you allow random people to chop off your legs, right? This is not what it means. It means that you look after yourself, but if somebody really pins you down, and you have no choice, then this is what happens. So, I don't know if I ever get invited back here, if I ever come back here. We're going to have a test, right? We're going to test one of you and see what is happening in the meantime, and we're going to see if you can... No, we're not going to do that. That would be terribly bad. Anyway, so that is all for this morning, and we'll see you again this afternoon at 3 o'clock.